I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. The New York Times has called her one of the foremost practitioners of the art of the short story. The Los Angeles Times, a writer to cherish, and the Chicago Tribune, a master storyteller whose works are more than big enough to hold the world. And if that were not convincing enough, Mona Simpson in the Atlantic Monthly has called her the living writer most likely to be read in 100 years. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Alice Munro. I'm very honored that she joins me today to discuss her latest collection of stories, Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, which is now available in paperback from Vintage, as well as her distinguished career, which includes 9 other collections of short stories and 1 novel. Alice Munro, welcome to my show.
Thank you.
Several stories in your latest collection have been given awards, but one in particular was honored this year in both the Best American Short Stories and the O. Henry Prize Stories. Do you have any inkling when you're writing a story like Family Furnishings that this is the one that's going to resonate the most with readers and critics?
You know, I think I believe this about every story I write, and that's what gives you courage to go through all the difficulties of writing a story. I believe in every story, as I'm doing it, that this is totally important, and I don't think ahead, I don't look behind, I'm just completely absorbed in that story. So they're like your children. You love them all in different ways. You see their flaws, but you love them anyway.
Well, many people probably assume that a story like that is autobiographical. After all, many of the details seem to come from your own life. The setting is similar to the one you grew up in. The narrator's mother is stricken with an unnamed disease, and your mother suffered from Parkinson's when you were young. The narrator gets a scholarship to go away to college. Same for you. The narrator becomes a writer. So I'm sure you've been asked this many times and often feel uncomfortable about it, but just how autobiographical would a story like this be?
That's an autobiographical story. I don't write many stories that are as plainly autobiographical as that. And in fact, I never set out to do that. But in this story, it just happened, and I went along with it, and it had to have this autobiographical framework. In a way, a story like that is somewhat close to a memoir, but still it works up a tension that's maybe different. And I must say, when I was writing this, I always think about using this autobiographical material yet again. And yet I think, well, this is still a story. This isn't really autobiography. This is using the autobiographical framework, and the story needs it, so I'll go ahead and do it.
And in the story, the narrator creates a rift between herself and her cousin by taking details from her cousin's life and fictionalizing them in a story. So is this, among other things, a story about fiction?
Of course it's a story about fiction, yes. And it's a story about it's a particular story. It's about a writer. And sometimes I distrust stories about writers, particularly stories in which the writer says, oh, how awful it is that I do this, but yet I have to. It's my art. And here I find myself writing that kind of story.
But do you think that's baloney when writers say that?
Well, it's not entirely baloney, but it's partly baloney, because you've got to face up to the fact that you do this. And that's why I end the story as I do. I want to end it with an affirmation. She does it. She is this kind of person. She is at odds, in a way, with her background, and yet she's using it. And she has not become the kind of person that, in a way, she admires and that her whole upbringing has trained her to be. And it's something like on the one side, there's family, and there's being this good person who puts others first. And this is especially true for women, this choice. And then, on the other hand, there is the thing you do, like the writing. And I'm not quite going to say you have to do it, because you could make a choice. You could not do it.
And for many years you didn't write.
But this is the choice, and you've done it. And then at the end of the story, she goes back to remembering what she first felt was the most important thing to do with her life and sort of accepts that choice.
Why do you think a story like this comes out now after so much other work?
You never know when things are going to come out. You think you're all finished with that part of your life. You think you're all finished with this character or that. And then you actually find yourself writing another story that takes the same material and finds out something new about it. The great American writer William Maxwell did this all his life. He mined the same ground, and he always found out something new. So this is sometimes what you do.
The title story, Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, can also be described as being about fiction. In this case, about bogus love letters.
That's right. It's more of a fun story, I think, because this has always interested me, the way things are misrepresented and the way things turn out. And I love working with letters. And in this case, of course, the letters are brilliantly successful fakes, which the girls don't know they will be, and things turn out quite differently.
You say you love working with letters. Letters were a basic device in the earliest fiction writing.
Yes, of course, Clarissa. Yes.
Richardson, and then we also have Les Liaisons Dangereuses and others.
Yes.
Do you see yourself as being tied to that tradition?
I've never read Clarissa. I've been told I should, but I'm saving it for my old age, which is coming up. And I didn't think of the tradition. I just found myself doing this, and I find it very interesting. I've also used diaries, and it's a neat way to get into a story. And it also varies the tone in a bit that I find refreshing.
You've only published one novel, Lives of Girls and Women, and that was in 1971. Do you think you'll ever write another one?
I always think I'll write a novel, and then it turns into a story. But experience is teaching me that I probably won't write another novel. And that novel actually is divided, in a way most novels aren't, into sections that are not quite stories. But I found when I was writing it that I couldn't handle the traditional novel form, and I wanted to put things into those kind of story boxes, so I did.
Well, your short stories are getting longer and longer.
They're getting longer and longer.
Some
Who
of them
knows?
Are over 50 pages in this
That's
book,
right.
almost novellas. So eventually you might just write three novellas and wind up with...
Actually, I count the pages and I wonder how near... Is this a novel?
Well, but the difference is that novels allow for a lot more digression, and that's
yes.
the reason some people prefer them. Short stories tend to be more concentrated. Do you think writing longer short stories is allowing you to be more novelistic?
I don't really understand what is novelistic. It's really allowing me to have more digression and more latitude and to put, you know, just to broaden out. And I know I like to do this. I've always liked to do it. But I'm not sure that this tendency would lead me to writing a novel. I seem to broaden out about it. I always do more than I expected, but it never changes in the way a novel should.
My guest is Alice Munro, and her latest book is a collection of short stories called Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, and it is now available in paperback from Vintage. Well, another thing that you're doing that's more like the novel is shifting perspective and following several different characters in these stories. So maybe it doesn't matter whether you write a novel or not, as long as you're doing the things you want to do. The only reason some people say they write novels is because of the economic pressures. Publishers tell them that short stories just don't sell as well.
Oh, yes. Well, I was told that in the beginning, before I'd ever published anything. A publisher told me that I'd have to guarantee to write a novel, and then he would publish the book as short stories. But I didn't agree to that, and because I didn't want to be under that kind of pressure. And it seems now that I've been very lucky. My publishers have been willing to take a chance on short stories, and I assume that they haven't gone broke doing this, and I haven't. So I can do it. And more people in my country, in Canada, seem to be doing stories now that are very good, very interesting. So maybe it's changing.
Well,
you can make a career this way.
You've also had the support of The New Yorker,
yes.
which is our leading publisher of short stories at this moment. And as long as they continue to publish you, you probably don't have to worry about whether you can support yourself.
That's true. The support of the New Yorker has been very important.
In your introduction to your 1996 selected stories, you respond to some of the questions that your readers have asked you over the years. Why did you decide to tackle those questions head-on in an introduction?
Well, it wasn't entirely my decision, because I do not like talking about writing. I always seem to do it badly or to miss the point. I seem to myself this way. So I just wanted the stories to be there. But apparently, it's much better when people are buying a kind of retrospective selection, if they can get some word from the author about why they might like to read this or what the stories are about or something. So I did write an introduction. And then when I got started on it, I kind of liked it because I was finding things out. And that's what talking about writing makes you do. You find you find what you have done long after you've done it. You find out why you've done it.
Mm-hmm. But you said you usually get it wrong. You get it wrong initially. That's when you're on the book tour, and that's why you've resisted going on book tours.
I don't get it completely wrong. I get partly wrong. I feel afterwards I've said something that doesn't tell everything, and because I haven't been able to express it or something like that. I always feel dissatisfied when I talk about writing.
But you also have to think about your relationship with your readers, especially in your case, where many readers feel some kind of proprietorship with you.
Well, maybe they do, but I really don't. I don't think about. I'm very grateful to my readers, and this is wonderful that they do feel something for my work. But when I'm writing, I don't think about anybody. I don't think about readers. I don't think about publishers. I don't think about a magazine. I think about how I want this story to exist.
So when you read later that people see you as a voice for feminism or a voice for Canada, for that matter, does that just seem totally alien to you?
It doesn't seem alien. I don't know how feminists define themselves right now, but I've always thought I was a feminist, and I'm certainly a Canadian, so what I write is going to reflect this somehow. I'm a woman writing. I'm a Canadian woman writing, and that's fine. I don't have to think about that.
Your daughter Sheila published a book last year that was part memoir and part biography
right.
of you.
Mm-hmm.
The sense I get from that was writing and being a mother was always a balancing act for
it
you.
It was certainly a balancing act, and I did it as well as I could. I think that there's a sense in which a mother who has some other strong interest is not maybe as constantly attentive to children as might be otherwise desirable. But I'm not sure about this. I just don't know. Our ideas of mothers and children keep changing. And I think I did a pretty good job as a mother.
Barbara Kingsolver told me that she wrote her first novel in the months before she gave birth. She knew she had to finish it before she went into labor, and she
yes.
did, I think, a day before. But that's another reason for writing short stories, isn't it?
That
you had to grab time.
Oh, it was the reason in the first place for writing short stories. I always planned to write a novel when I had time. And I just couldn't take the time when the children were small and when I had responsibilities. So I got into the habit of writing stories and learned how to write them.
Had you come from a literary family?
Well, you know, I sort of do, because it wasn't that we thought of ourselves as literary at all. But later on, after I had published a few books, my father wrote a book. He wrote a novel about pioneer life in Ontario. So obviously it was something he'd wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly nobody ever told me you can be a writer. And I never told anybody that I wanted to be a writer. It would have seemed like taking a great leap of faith that I was not justified to take.
But were you secretly desiring to be a writer?
Of course. I said I wanted to be a journalist because that seemed, you know, more sensible.
And meanwhile, you waited a while until you actually ventured into writing.
Oh, no. I was writing all the time from the time I was about. I sold my first story when I was 20 years old, but it took me a long time to get enough stories for a collection, about 15 years.
Many people have pointed out that your ability to write simply gorgeous and stunning, that you have this ability to write gorgeous and stunning sentences. It's hard to imagine how somebody gets that good without studying writing or without working.
Oh, I read all the time. I read from the time I was about 14. And during the decade between 20 and 30, when I was at home with small children, I tried to get through all the great works of the 20th century. I had this voracious appetite, and nothing stopped me.
You've been compared most often with Chekhov. Was he one of the writers that you favored?
I love Chekhov, yes. But I didn't know Chekhov until I was probably over 20. And I wouldn't say I imitated, but that the writers that I felt closest to, really, were a lot of American writers. A lot of them were Southerners. Carson McCullers, Flannery O'Connor, Eudora Welty, Catherine Ann Porter. And all of their stories were very important to me because they treated material that was closer to my own.
Short story writers.
Yes.
There was a time in the 60s, maybe, or even a little later, when psychology and insight stopped being major concerns for many writers. But here you are, a writer in the grand tradition, and readers continue to love it.
What grand tradition?
Well,
psychology?
Look at why people
do what they do, characters who... Yes.
People read stories of yours and say, and connect it to their own lives.
And every once in a while I read that this is all finished.
Yes.
We don't write like this anymore.
Well, the postmodernism was supposed to have killed that off. So have you ever thought of
it? I don't think it's killed off a lot of writing. I mean that's maybe what people are saying in academic life or something, but in criticism maybe. But there are lots and lots of writers writing in the tradition that we're talking about. It's the old storytelling character.
Although few get to be described as the greatest, or one of the greatest living writers working in English. Alice Munro, her latest collection of stories is called Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage. It's published by Vintage. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. This is WNYC at 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope talking to Alice Munro, who has just published her 10th collection of short stories called Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage. It's from Vintage, actually. It's now available in paperback. It was available originally in hardcover. There's also one novel, kind of a novel, called Lives of Girls and Women. Ms. Munro has won so many awards, I'm not even going to go through the whole list, but it's quite impressive. you live relatively close to where you grew up, don't you?
Yes.
And that is that because it continues to form the setting of so much of what you write about?
Well, it does, but I didn't plan any of this. I moved away from that part of Canada when I was 20, and in my first marriage I lived for over 20 years in British Columbia, in Victoria and Vancouver, in the suburbs and so on. And then I moved back, not for reasons that had anything to do with writing, but had reasons to do with falling in love with my second husband. So I wasn't thinking about where can I write, where can I get my material. I was always sure the material would still come to me, you know, from wherever I was.
So if you were living in New York, you still would probably write about this area?
Yes, I think I would write a good deal about it. That isn't the only thing I write about. I know most people think I am this sort of rural Ontario writer, but I do write with other backgrounds too. And so I would probably write a bit about wherever I was living, but I would still probably be mining this, as we say, autobiographical material and the stories I'd heard around my home.
And the landscape and the setting, mm-hmm. which are both mm-hmm. beautiful and monotonous,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
equally important.
Monotony can be rather beautiful. Yeah.
Why is that? Because it allows for more reflection?
I don't know. It just has a different... landscapes that are monotonous, like the prairies or like the Fens or something like this is poetic. It's mysterious. It doesn't have points that you have to pay attention to, but it has a kind of total effect that I think is beautiful.
Do the characters reflect their surroundings?
Probably they do, without being particularly aware of it, because the surroundings of the country I write about they're not particularly noticed. This is not a landscape that is easy to describe, and it's fairly nondescript, but people are living their lives and aware of the seasons, aware of what they're surrounded by.
You're known for, among other things, writing stories with very complex structures. You don't always start at the beginning, and you jump around in time quite a bit. Is that a reflection of the way your mind works? Is that the way your stories occur to you?
Yes, it's the way the stories happen. And sometimes I write them in segments, and then I rearrange the segments. But I don't do this to be perverse or to give the reader trouble. I just do it because it seems that that is the way the story unfolds, with paying attention to this and then paying attention to this and then coming back and seeing what really happened here and so on. It seems to be very important to make the story this way. And I don't really know why.
So you could easily have written a story in a linear fashion and
then in the
revisions and the rewrites have
But I assure you I don't do it to be difficult.
No, I think it's part of what makes them
it's what makes people understand the story or what it's about better.
At times I feel like you're trying to get your readers to move into the future and the past at the same time.
Well, in some stories, I will make a jump ahead, and then I'll make a jump back, which explains something,
mm-hmm.
or that sheds a new light. I think that's more it, that it will shed a light on what has already happened in a more straightforward narrative. But I don't think about this. I mean, I don't plan it out, really, though I do rearrange. It's just a sort of... It's a feeling I have for what comes next. And I haven't decided why. I just feel that it does.
And have you always written that way, or were some of
your earlier stories a little more conventional?
They
were more straightforward, I'm sure.
How did they begin for you? Because different writers have told me different things. Richard Ford once told me that his stories and novels often begin with one word that's made its way into his head. And then that word then just keeps on leading them in all sorts of different directions.
They begin in different ways. Some of mine begin in the way you would expect, with an anecdote. The first story in this book, the title story, began in that way. Others are totally, totally different. There's no anecdote. There's a scene. There's one scene. And I have to go backwards and forwards and around from that.
Although you wrote in that introduction to Selected Stories that the scene, which is the secret of the story, may not seem to be close to what it's about. I wasn't sure what you meant by that.
It's dreadful when my words get quoted back to me. I've got to figure out what did I mean. But okay. The scene which starts the story may be the dramatic thing, the hook on which you're caught, in which I, as the writer, was caught. And then what the story means, why it's worth writing, may not be what shows up in that dramatic scene. It's built around it. It trails away from it. It's a sidelight or something like that. But don't ask me to say what any story means. I just know when it's there. I feel it when it's there, but it would be very hard to tell people.
Well, as you've been hinting again and again, you feel uncomfortable analyzing your stories too much. Perhaps it would take some of the magic out of them for you.
It isn't that I fear the magic going out of them. It's that I'm incapable of doing it. I mean, if you asked me to speak Greek, I would also fail.
My guest is Alice Munro. A new paperback has been issued of her 10th collection of short stories called Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, which is the title of one of the stories. When you were bringing up three daughters and you were just catching as much time as you could to write, you must have developed certain work habits. Have they changed now that you no longer have to grab time whenever it's available?
Yeah, my writing time has changed, but I'm still sort of writing in a protected time. Now I like to get up and write, make coffee, and start writing immediately, and write from, say, 7 o'clock until 10 o'clock, because that seems to me now the part of the day that is freest from interruption. Mm-hmm. When I had kids, it was when I got them off to school. And then I wrote till noon, stopped and made lunch for them, wrote a bit in the afternoon and quit.
Do you also like to read when you're writing?
You mean, do I avoid reading serious stuff when I'm writing? Sometimes I do. I like reading magazines, you know, and just picking up. And when I'm really deep into something and it's giving me a lot of trouble, I don't generally read anything very important or demanding.
Because it would demand too much of you, or because you're also afraid that you read a little Joseph Conrad and say, oh, my God.
Exactly. Oh, my God. No, it's just as if my mind is being worn out with the problem. And when I stop working, I just want to relax and do something very trivial.
Much of your work concerns the role of memory in people's lives. Often you give us several people's memories that don't exactly match up. We see that, for example, in family furnishings. Why does that interest you so much as subject
matter? Oh, I think it's one of the most interesting things there is, the way we all construct a different story of our lives. And the people, this, I think, is one of the big problems with biography. It's impossible. This is a story of a life, and yet everybody in it would have a different take on this life, and we see our lives differently at different times, different ages. So it's so mysterious, and it's as if we were all doing this sort of construction that isn't quite matching up.
You also seem to be saying that a character's memory of a particular event tells us something about that character.
Oh, usually it does. Of course, we make our memories selective, and we make up stories. This really interests me. We make up stories to make a narrative of a life that is agreeable to us, most of us do.
Another theme that's run through much of your fiction has been the tension between domesticity and independence felt by women. It's just as present in your latest collection as it's been in a lot of the past work.
You mean I haven't outgrown it? No, I haven't.
Well, it's obviously something that interests you a lot.
It's for me, but it's partly, this is my generation. And I don't know if one of the things that I'd really like to know is, do younger women feel this? And maybe they don't, because they've been brought up with different expectations entirely. But with me, there's a big, big tension between wanting to do anything like writing that's very demanding and all the other things that a woman should do, in which she creates. You know, women were really in charge of creating life, creating this, not just birthing children, but creating the home, the setting, the emotions, which made life more comfortable for the people around them.
Has your understanding of this tension changed over the years?
I don't know if my understanding of it has changed, or if I think about it less or more. It's always there.
Women are caught between two longings, and you're saying they it's always going to be the same, although they may not perceive it in the same way.
I don't know if it's the same, because I haven't talked to younger women about this, and I think there's been a big shift, but I don't know.
You talked earlier about looking at the same material and finding new ways to write about it. Are you taking on subjects that you wouldn't have when you started out?
Yes, I have a very big subject right now, which I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it would take a lot out of me, and I don't know if I'm up for it, but I would love to take it on. Yeah. Mm.
Well, I'm so glad that you came here and took this show on, because it's been just wonderful talking with you. Alice Munro, Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, her 10th collection of short stories is just out from Vintage, and I don't need a novel from you. I'm happy with these stories.
Oh, good.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.